Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, fairly often we do things on science and technology, and in fact, a good percentage of those tend to be on astronomy and cosmology and space exploration. And today's show is one of those. I have with me as my guest Scott Bolton, Associate Vice President R&D at Southwest Research Institute. That institute is headquartered in San Antonio, Texas. Scott's joining me from there. He's the principal investigator on NASA's Juno spacecraft mission to the planet Jupiter. Juno was launched in August 2011 and successfully entered Jupiter's orbit on July 4th after traveling 1.7 billion miles through space. It's the first time a space probe has gone to Jupiter, and it's a major success in space exploration. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you on. I read that you were quoted that night as saying, you know, while everybody was cheering around you and there was a lot of adrenaline and jubilation flowing and possibly some champagne, I don't know. We just did the hardest thing NASA's ever done, you said, which I guess makes it harder than the moon missions and the more recent Mars missions. So unless you were just exuberantly exaggerating, that's a pretty cool thing. How did it feel at that moment to know that Juno had made it to Jupiter exactly as planned? How did it feel as the mission leader and just personally?
Well, it was a huge sigh of relief mixed with incredible excitement. Of course, when I said that statement, I thought I was only talking to the team. I didn't realize it was going up on NASA TV. But, you know, the idea was not to take anything away from the incredible moon landings or any of the other great feats that NASA engineers and scientists have been able to accomplish over the years.
Sure.
But it was really aimed at the idea that this really was the harshest region in the entire solar system that we have attempted to attack and conquer. That represented a very, very special challenge. And so I was just, it was incredible that we, you know, armored the spacecraft and went in to this horrible, harsh region and managed to make it work. And that's really what I was sort of excited and speaking about, was this was the hardest challenge that we've overcome as far as a challenge against nature.
Yeah, and it was the farthest away as far as putting a man-made object into orbit around it. So, I mean, to get more in detail, what were some of the main technical challenges involved in entering Jupiter's orbit way out there?
Well, the first and most spoken about challenge is just what's called the radiation. There are Jupiter is surrounded by incredibly high energy particles, electrons and protons, that are moving near the speed of light. And you know, if a human went there, we would die almost instantly. And even electronics would die right away because this radiation just goes in and zaps the electronics. And so that is by far the harshest region in the solar system because of Jupiter's incredible mass and the fact that it is the giant planet. It's basically a planet on steroids, so everything about it is extreme. So this harsh region is many, many times worse than what we have here at the Earth, although we have radiation belts here. They're nothing like Jupiter's. It also has the strongest magnetic field. I mean, and we had never sent a spacecraft into a magnetic field that strong. And you've got this moving spacecraft that's spinning through the magnetic field, and basically you're creating currents and forces that are also disruptive to electronics and the way the spacecraft works. So you have and these two types of environments are impossible to even create here on the Earth. We couldn't even create a laboratory to test the spacecraft in because you'd have to be as powerful as Jupiter to create that lab. So you had the strongest magnetic field, the harshest radiation. Jupiter has got the strongest gravity field that we've encountered. And because of that, you're moving incredibly fast through this region. And on top of that, there's, you know, sort of unknown ring particles and because we've never visited that region precisely, we don't really know the extent of the ice and micrometeorite-type particles that, if any one of them hits Juno when it's moving at that speed, would basically just punch a hole right through it.
So you knew in general what the risks were, but you didn't know in detail what the extent of them was or where they'd be clustered or that kind of thing, and there must be fluctuations as you're going around, you know. So how did you deal with that uncertainty? Did you just harden the heck out of it to to accommodate everything you could afford to do as far as payload weight went?
That's exactly right. We took every bit of mass that we could and threw it into the armored shielding. I mean, we basically are an armored tank, so going into battle. And in the same way, the military, you know, you don't know exactly what they're up against. They just make the meanest tank they can. We made the meanest spacecraft we knew how to do, and we modeled the environment based on, you know, measurements that we made elsewhere and sort of just theoretical guesses. And then we added conservatism, margin, and reserve on top of that. Basically, we threw everything we knew how to shield it.
And it worked. So what was the riskiest point, you know, from the time of launch to planetary approach to orbit? I mean, at what point was the risk factor redlined?
So generally, when you think about a NASA mission like Juno's, there's two incredibly high-risk spots, even without Jupiter's radiation and all of the environment. You would have the launch being one of the most highly risk events there is, because you're sitting on top of a rocket. If anything goes wrong with that rocket, and we've all seen rockets that didn't go in the right direction or didn't make it off the pad the right way. So there's a high risk associated with launch itself. That happened back in 2011. And then the next biggest risk is getting into orbit. And NASA's done that, Mars. We've done it at Jupiter before, and we did it at Saturn. So there are different times where you have to make these burns, and other places where you had to, you know, get into orbit around the moon, for instance. So there's a high risk associated with it, just because the rocket motor has to fire at exactly the right time in the right direction. And so that represents a huge challenge. The fact that you were going into the worst environment on something that was already considered high risk is what really put Juno over the top as far as, you know, challenges that we were trying to face.
Jupiter's so far away. How far away is it, and how long does it take commands to reach the spacecraft? And I guess the point of that question is, how much of these commands you're talking about were pre-programmed in advance, and how much did you guys have to initiate through the mission team on Earth at exactly the right second?
So Jupiter's pretty far away. It's five times the distance from the sun that the Earth is. So Earth is about 100 million miles, and so Jupiter's roughly orbiting at about 500 million miles away. And depending on where the Earth is around the sun, and depending on where Jupiter is, in other words, if we're on the same side of the sun, we're a little closer to Jupiter. And if we're on the other side of the sun, then we're even further, right? So we were, I think at the time that we went into orbit, it took about 48 minutes for the light or the radio signals from Juno to get back to Earth. Or from Earth, if we were going to try to send commands up, it would take 48 minutes for them to reach Juno. So you're looking at a little over an hour and a half round trip,
really,
in communication time. The whole burn is only 35 minutes and has to happen right at the right time. So there's no way to help Juno. I mean, by the time Juno would have sent us a signal saying, there's something wrong, what do I do, it would have passed Jupiter.
Yeah.
By the time we even found out or sent a signal to help. So everything has to be pre-programmed.
Okay.
So there's a sequence on board in its computer that clocks off right down to the microsecond every single command and function that the spacecraft has to do.
It's always so incredible that works so far away after so much buffeting and so much that it's gone through. So you were talking about, you know, obviously Jupiter is so big and its gravity is so strong that it takes, I gather, 53 days to complete an orbit of the planet, and I guess that's compared to about 90 minutes to orbit Earth. So the orbital altitude you're at is about, I was reading, 2,600 miles above the planet's cloud tops, which is about 10 times higher than near-Earth orbit for the space shuttle, for example. Juno will orbit Jupiter only 37 times in just under 2 years because it takes so long to get around. I mean, almost 2 months to get around it, right? And so what will it observe as it's doing that?
We'll observe a lot of stuff, but let me first talk about the orbits a little bit.
Okay.
So the first orbit is 53 days long, and it's not circular. Like when you think about the space shuttle orbit or the space station orbit or any of the communication satellites that we have around the Earth, they're more or less going around the Earth at a given altitude, so it's sort of like a circle going around the Earth. Juno's not in a circle. It's in an ellipse. So one side of that ellipse is only 2,600 miles or about 5,000 kilometers above the cloud tops. The other side is pretty far away. Right now, Juno is not very close to Jupiter. It's millions of miles away because it came in really close and then it started moving away on this big orbit. And the orbit's 53 days long. So at about halfway through, Juno will turn around and start coming back toward Jupiter. now we have two orbits planned that are 53 days long. So the next time Juno gets close to Jupiter is about August 27th, and then we will be at about 3,000 miles away from the cloud tops. And then it will move away again and take another 53 days. So sometime in October, we'll fire the rocket motor again, slowing us down even more. And that will bring the orbit down so that it's only 14 days long. And we will do the mapping with a 14-day orbit. Every other Wednesday, basically, we'll be really close to Jupiter, and it'll still be an ellipse, so it'll go further away and then come back. Every other Wednesday will be Science Day.
Is that elliptical orbit totally driven and controlled by gravity? I mean, how do you do that? You think it'd have to be circular in order to keep gravity even on it. When you get further away, it's less gravity. So how do you do an elliptical orbit using gravity?
In fact, all the planets' orbits are a little bit elliptical.
Yeah.
Some are a little more than others. So it would take a lot more energy to make it circular.
Hmm.
I mean, basically what happens is when you get captured, right, when Juno gets captured by Jupiter, it gets grabbed, but it's still moving pretty fast, so it gets to keep moving away, and that's why the orbit's 53 days. So I have to apply more and more energy into the orbit in order to make it more and more circular. NASA could design something that eventually would be circular around Jupiter, and then it would be whipping around really fast, but it would also be in this incredibly harsh region all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The reason Juno can last for the 33 orbits or 37 orbits total is because we move away from the harsh regions, basically like a dive bomber. We come in and we come flying through the thing really fast. We spend about 2 hours going pole to pole when we're really close. And then the rest of the time is spent far away where it's much safer. And then we come in for another dive bomb attack. And each time we get a very special sampling of the science. Almost all the most important science is done within that couple of hours. That's what's unique about Juno's view, is you're really up close and personal, but you can't stay there. You got to, you know, get in and get out. It's sort of like if you were trying to dance through a fire, you would not stand in the fire for very long. You usually just walk across it, and even that is pretty dangerous, right? So we're running through the harshest fire you can imagine.
Yeah, like trying to videotape a volcano while it's erupting or something nearby. But
exactly. You got to fly over it really fast, and even then, you might get nailed.
You are listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Scott Bolton, who is the Associate Vice President for R&D at the Southwest Research Institute, but also the principal investigator of the Juno spacecraft mission to Jupiter. And Juno just recently entered Jupiter's orbit to do a lot of science there. So, Scott, what will the spacecraft be observing?
Juno has three different ways that it looks inside of Jupiter to try to see how it's built. We want to learn what the structure's like inside and what is it made of. In particular, we're looking for evidence of a core of heavy elements. Is it all hydrogen and helium all the way down, or is there a core of rocky material in the middle of it? And if so, how big that core might be, as well as how is it structured inside? How is it spinning in its interior? And how much water or oxygen is in the planet? And those two or three kinds of questions really address how Jupiter formed and how planets in general are made. We also look at the atmosphere, the deep dynamics, how deep are the zones and belts, how deep are the roots to the Great Red Spot.
Mm.
We'll see that for the first time. As well as, since we're going over the poles, we'll be studying Jupiter's northern lights, northern and southern lights, the aurora of Jupiter.
So I know that Jupiter is a gas planet, which is, I guess, the Earth is a rocky planet, but does that mean there's some possibility that it's comprised completely of gas and doesn't have a core, or do we know there's a core, we just don't know how big and what it's made of?
We don't know if there's a core or not.
Hmm.
We know that it's almost all hydrogen and helium by mass, and that's very almost the same as the sun or almost any other object that we see out in space. These big clouds are almost all hydrogen and helium. Most of the universe is hydrogen and helium, at least most of the ordinary matter that we know. What we learned, and the curious thing about Jupiter, is that it's enriched over the sun with something that cosmologists call heavy elements, so the carbon, the nitrogen, the sulfur, these other things that are on the chemistry table beyond helium, and they're heavier. You know, they have more protons and electrons than a hydrogen or helium atom do. So the ones that have been measured show that Jupiter has about 3 to 4 times, in percentage-wise, of these other heavy elements compared to the Sun. So while it's similar, it's almost all hydrogen and helium, it's got this enrichment of this rocky material. Still very little of it, but nevertheless, it's more than what the Sun has. And so we don't understand why that is or how it happened. But we know it's important because the stuff that Jupiter has more of is what Earth is made out of. It's what life is made out of. In fact, it's what all the planets are made out of. They have all this enrichment. So something was happening very early in the solar system that enabled Jupiter to get more of this heavy element and mixture. That's likely the key to how you make solar systems and planets in general. Whatever process eventually led to Earth being created was already being initiated at the time Jupiter was forming. And so what we're really looking for is clues as to how that worked and when and where. And you're basically going after what I term as the recipe for solar systems.
So that's a big overall mission tied to the specific things you're looking at. Jupiter does have moons, right? I mean, and they're rocky, I think.
Correct. It has a lot of moons. It has the 4 Galilean moons that are famous from when Galileo first saw them, and they're bigger than the rest. But then it has another 60 or so moons that are, some are small, some are not, that are icy, rocky material. And, of course, I imagine Juno will discover even more of those.
Does that imply that there must be a core of rocky material in the interior if there's so many rocks circling Jupiter?
No, it doesn't say anything about when or how Jupiter formed. The rocky material in the middle of Jupiter implies that there were rocks or ices that were gathering in the solar system prior to Jupiter forming. So Jupiter's thought to be the very first planet that formed, partly because it's so massive. There were leftovers after the Sun formed, and Jupiter sucked up more than half of them. So if I take everything else in the solar system besides the Sun, they're all less than Jupiter. I mean, all the other planets put together. And the question is were there rocky materials in the early solar system that were already clumping together and then Jupiter got built around it? Or did Jupiter form like we think the Sun did, which is it just collapsed from the leftovers, which is what we think the Sun just formed from a cloud of gas and dust. So I think the fact that there are rocky or icy moons around Jupiter, they could have formed and most likely formed after Jupiter was already there and may have actually been captured by Jupiter by just simply having an orbit, part of the debris, you know, as after the planets form, there's still rocky stuff left out from the debris that are moving around the Sun. And if they get too close to Jupiter, they get captured in the same way that Juno gets captured.
You mentioned a while ago the Great Red Spot of Jupiter, which I think most people are familiar with, and I think that's been there as long as we've been aware of and able to see Jupiter. So what is the Great Red Spot?
Well, we don't actually know. I mean, what we know is that it's a giant storm. It looks a little bit like a hurricane on the Earth, but it can't be powered the same way because there's no land or sea underneath it. It's all gas underneath it. It's curious, one, because it's so large. It's bigger than the Earth itself, and it's lasted so long. I mean, there's records of it going back hundreds of years. And so many scientists believe that implies very deep roots. And we don't really understand what makes up the color. Presumably it's some sort of chemistry or something being churned up from below. So Juno will investigate that in some unique ways, in the sense that we have an instrument on board that uses microwaves. It's a microwave receiver, a little bit like your DirecTV dish or satellite TV dish, where it works off of microwaves. And we listen to Jupiter, and we're able to see down beneath the tops of the clouds. And so we'll investigate as we drop down into Jupiter's atmosphere whether there's evidence that the Great Red Spot exists, you know, 100 kilometers down or different depths down, and does it get smaller or bigger, and how does it evolve as you dive down into Jupiter? So we do that remotely. We don't actually dive in. We just measure beneath the cloud tops in the same sense that radar, of course, that's active, but radar can see through the clouds and even see into sand or sea a little bit. it bounces a signal off, a microwave signal off in the land, and looks at the reflection. We don't bounce anything off because there's nothing to bounce off of, but we listen because Jupiter is emitting because it's warm. So we're watching the warmth of Jupiter come out, and from that we can learn about the structure of the atmosphere.
You talked about the roots of the Great Red Spot just briefly before we leave that topic. Does the spot move around on the surface, or does it stay rooted in one place?
It moves around. In fact, Jupiter's, all the zones and belts are blowing around in some of different directions and at different speeds, and the Great Red Spot is doing the same thing. So it's a little bit hard to predict exactly where it will be. So we have this mapping technique where we go into different over different longitudes, and we're aiming at one of them early on. We should see a hint of, or go over near the red spot, if not right over it, on August 27th. But we have other chances to do it if it moves out of the way. But you can usually predict it a month or two out. But saying where that would be 2 years from now would be very difficult.
Back on the spacecraft itself, I think Juno was the fastest human-made object ever built. So at a speed of 165,000 miles an hour, it's seven times faster than Apollo 11 and 122 times faster than the Concorde, which was a fast jet. What made it so fast compared to all other spacecraft?
Basically getting close to Jupiter. It's Jupiter's gravity field sucking it in and accelerating the spacecraft, pulling it in. So it was, any rocket gets you going pretty fast. But the thing that sets the records is getting really close to the most massive object, and that's what increased that speed so high. Of course, when you go to measure the speed and you try to say, okay, how fast is this relative to other stuff, you run right into a problem right away of saying, well, the speed relative to what? Mm-hmm. Some people say, well, make the speed relative to the Earth because it's human-made. Or somebody else would say, no, make the speed relative to Jupiter, or count the speed relative to the Sun. Or I've had people say, the center of the galaxy. You have to say relative to what. Of course, the engineers who are putting us into orbit and controlling the navigation, they have to know the speed relative to everything. They measure the speed relative to the Sun, they're measuring the speed relative to Jupiter, and they have to know the speed relative to Earth. So for that speed that you quoted is relative to the Earth, and it's relative to the average Earth speed because the Earth is also going around the Sun. So I'm trying not to count, in our case, the Earth's going around and Jupiter's going north and south, so the Earth speed isn't that important. But you can imagine if you went the opposite direction of the Earth, you would be going much faster relative to the Earth, but that's not doesn't represent the same kind of speed.
And I know the spacecraft is solar-powered. It must have some awfully big solar power panels to be picking up significant energy that far away from the Sun. Why was solar power chosen over nuclear, which has been the kind of the go-to power system for long-travel spacecraft before?
So we went with solar power largely because there was no nuclear power available at the time we were designing and developing the concept for Juno. And so we had no choice, but we basically just took a look and said, could we do this with solar power? And the solar arrays are quite large, as you point out. They're about 9 meters long each. There's three of them. And even with all of those solar arrays, out at the distance that Jupiter is, you're only getting 1/25th the amount of sunlight that you would get near the Earth. And so the spacecraft has to be very, very efficient. It's running on a few hundred watts.
Are there risks for the continued success of Juno's mission, or is it smooth sailing from here on, pretty much?
Oh, no, it's very high risk. I mean, the first time we flew by, we got into orbit, but we don't actually know that much about the environment that we just flew by. We had all the science instruments off, so we basically didn't have our eyes and ears open. We just kind of closed our eyes and
crossed our fingers
down and went through it, and it worked. But on August 27th, we go by for the first time with everything on and open, and we'll see how bad the environment really is. You know, the risk is that, Juno is still going to encounter more and more radiation every time it comes by. And every time it goes by Jupiter in each of those orbits, the amount of radiation it gets is going to increase. And that's basically what's going to define the end of the mission. And so the risks are not over. In fact, they get worse each time we come by.
Yeah, radiation's kind of like a withering fire of little tiny, tiny bullets that eventually degrade and tear apart electronics in particular. So, but I mean, Juno has a two-year mission planned, right? So I guess you're planning that it will survive for 2 years. But I'm thinking of the rovers on Mars, the Spirit and Opportunity, that performed for many years, longer than expected, like 50 times as long as they were planned to do. We got more bang for the buck out of them than any space mission ever. But is there any chance Juno might do the same and just keep running and running?
Very little, because I mean the Mars rovers don't have the kind of environment that to deal with that Juno has, and so we know in the last orbits that Juno is getting more and more radiation. It may last a little bit longer, but it won't be, you know, another 10 years like you see in some of these missions. I mean, there's missions like Voyager that are still working, that were launched in the 70s, mm-hmm. and they're pushing the edge of the solar system. It's incredible they're still working. Those are probably some of the longest-lasting missions that I know of.
Scott, we just have a minute or so left, really, so kind of a short answer if there is one. Is there any possibility of life on Jupiter?
I always try to keep an open mind and not be too egocentric or human-centric with it. I mean, we see life is incredibly versatile here on the Earth. And everywhere there's liquid water, there's life, and the life takes all kinds of different forms. In the deepest oceans where we don't think there's even oxygen or sunlight, these things are living off of sulfur and other types of things that we've never have guessed. So it's always possible in Jupiter there's a life form that we haven't imagined. But if there is a life there, it's nothing like we have here, nothing like we've ever seen. And Juno is not designed to try to detect that type of phenomena. I mean, if an alien came out and met us with a spaceship, we'd certainly see it. But it's not. It doesn't have measurements or instruments on there that are seeking to find evidence of life on Jupiter.
Sure.
It's really looking at what formed Jupiter and what can that tell us about the origin of Earth and the rest of the solar system and where we all came from.
Well, Scott, it's been fascinating, and congratulations to you and your team for a successful mission so far, and it looks like you're going to gather a lot of information, you know, new knowledge about the biggest planet in our solar system, Jupiter. Those of you out there who want to learn more, you can go to YouTube and enter Jupiter Juno Mission, and you'll see a whole selection of different videos about the mission, and I guess as time goes on, there'll be photos and that kind of thing from it. But Scott Bolton, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Thank you very much for having me. One of the best videos to watch is the approach made to Jupiter. We made a movie of Jupiter and the Galilean moons going around it. It's about 3 minutes long. You'll see for the first time ever, really, planetary motion and how it all works. So I encourage you to go check out that YouTube video.
Is there a name to it so they can pick that one quickly out of the list?
Yeah, it's a Juno's approach to Jupiter and the Galilean satellites.
Okay, good enough. Well, thanks again, Scott, and thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.